You're listening to A Real Piece of Work. I probably shouldn't say it that way. You're listening to A Real Piece of Work, a jobs podcast for aspiring professionals, brought to you by WVIK, Quad Cities NPR, and Junior Achievement of the Heartland. Now here's your hosts, Matt and Joy.
Hey, Mark, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Matt. How about you?
I'm doing wonderful. Couldn't be more excited. We got an awesome guest today. And what's really getting me excited, it's interesting. The last month, I've seen the highs of my high school daughter winning a state championship in track.
Nice.
And then on the coattails of that, I was hugging her Tuesday night as her high school soccer team got beat in their quarterfinal soccer game in the state tournament. And it just hit me as I was doing a little research about our guest about why losing is good. And I can't wait to hear why that is. So that's getting me going for this podcast recording today. How about you?
I'm a fan of Pat McAfee, who got me onto Barstool Sports. So he actually sat behind me in my junior year geology 101 class at West Virginia University.
Wow.
And I will say that his time in media actually has made me like him, because back then I could not hear the professor because he was cutting it up so much behind me. So with that, you know, I might ask a couple Pat McAfee questions in there. But, you know, I'm just a big fan of podcasting and, you know, alternative forms of media. So, you know, I'm excited to, you know, see what our guest is up to now, but also hear how you take a small blog and turn it into the juggernaut that is Barstool Sports. So that's what I'm stoked about today, Matt.
Well, in that vein then, welcome to Erica Ayers-Badon, our guest here on A Real Piece of Work. So welcome, Erica.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, we appreciate it. So Erica, we're going to jump right in here. So as I was reading your bio, it says you are the CEO of Food 52. Can you tell our listeners, our high school listeners and others, what that means and what is Food 52?
Sure. So Food 52 is a home food and lifestyle company. It was started by two women in, you know, kind of the early 2000s. One was a very lauded New York Times cookbook writer. And they believed, similar to what Dave Portnoy and the guys at Barstool believed, that there was a different way to have fans and talk about what was happening at home and making recipes and talking about what was happening in the kitchen. And so they created this startup called Food 52, which was about food, you know, it was for at-home cooks, and it was about food 52 weeks a year. And they built it into a very interesting commerce company where they sold products and you know, curated goods from all around the world. They started to make their own products based on what their community was telling them, which today seems very obvious and, you know, kind of commonplace. But, you know, in 2012, 2013, it was less so. And I joined them officially about a month ago. I've been on the board for quite some time and an advisor even before that. And I joined them because I really believe that home and food and life is a very interesting place for content. And it's a very interesting place to create products.
So what's a typical day look like for you now that you've transitioned into Food 52?
It's a little bit different. So I was the CEO of Barstool Sports before this, which is pretty much akin to working in like a college frat house. Food 52 is very pretty. It's very clean. there's better snacks. But a typical day, you know, I spend a lot of time meeting with people. I spend a lot of time figuring out, you know, what are the problems we're having? What are the obstacles right in front of us? Who needs a nudge? Who needs a push? Who needs help? Where do I need help? And really bringing, you know, we have a really talented team here, and I spend a lot of time figuring out how do we put that team into motion with one another to go achieve new things for the people who work at the company as well as for the business.
So out of curiosity, in 2022, Forbes named Food 52 one of the most innovative companies out there. Is that part of the DNA? Is that still something that your company's proud of? And what does that do for a company like you when you're named that?
Oh, I think it's good. You know, I think it's nice to be recognized by other companies. I think most companies that are very innovative know it from within, and that's very important. You know, I think companies are like people like that, where you know if you're being challenged, you know if you're breaking the norm, you know if you're pushing the boundaries. But I think, you know, it's nice to be recognized, you know, as an innovative company, because it's true, and it helps Food 52 compete with much bigger companies. Food 52 competes with Crate and Barrel. They compete with Pottery Barn. They compete with Williams Sonoma. They compete with Condé Nast. So it's nice for this underdog company to be recognized by someone like Forbes. And it, you know, it's a good shot in the arm to keep things going.
So is your education, that your formal education, how did it prepare you for this? Do you have like a food background, or is there
else? I'm a terrible cook. I didn't tell them that before I got the job, but maybe I should have. I went to college. I was in Maine. I was a sociology major and a philosophy minor. I played a lot of sports. I really wanted, you know, I kind of realized my junior year in college that I wanted to work in business. My parents were teachers. I really wasn't sure what I was qualified to do or wanted to do when I grew up. I was lucky enough to get an internship at Fidelity Investments, which kind of propelled me into my first job. And, you know, I think the reason I'm a good fit for Food 52 is I've been at a startup, you know, called Barstool Sports for about 10 years. And we did a lot and learned a lot and grew a lot and disrupted a lot. And, you know, my hope is to be able to do the same thing.
So you've touched a couple times on Barstool. Would you, for maybe some of the listeners that aren't aware, what's the Barstool story and impact it had in your career being their first CEO?
Yeah, I think, you know, Barstool Sports is a comedy, lifestyle, entertainment company. They endeavor to use the internet to make people laugh. We've launched all sorts of stars and personalities. Barstool Trent is from Iowa. Pat McAfee is, you know, from Indiana.
West Virginia originally, though. He's from Pittsburgh originally, and then he came to WVU.
That is, you are correct with that, Mark. So he now lives in Indiana.
Yes.
Because he played for the Colts. So what's interesting about Barstool is it was started as a paper in 2004 by a gentleman named Dave Portnoy. And it grew, kind of became like a cult favorite in Boston for young sports fans and guys who wanted to hear from someone who kind of called things like they were and said things that were pretty funny and sometimes was outrageous in ways that other people wouldn't be. And I joined the company in 2016 as their first CEO. And we really exploded the company after that. We moved into podcasting, we moved into video, we moved into streaming, we moved into social media. And we really grew the brand from about 5 million followers to, you know, over 250 million followers.
Wow.
Sorry, this is so loud.
Oh, you're fine.
Okay, fine. Sorry about that.
You're cool.
So we grew the brand to over 250 million followers. And, you know, arguably Barstool is really a cultural force at this point. If you're talking about college, if you're talking about sports betting, if you're talking about sports in general, if you're talking about what's happening on TikTok, there's somebody at Barstool who's talking about it that most young people are listening to.
That's awesome.
Well, let me jump in here real quick, Matt, because my background, I'm a classical musician. I play French horn in the Quad City Symphony Orchestra. But as a part of my work kind of promoting music throughout my career, I've been able to learn how to create a podcast and then came over here to the public radio station to, you know, help build audience for a whole host of local podcasts here in the Quad Cities. So talk to me about the importance of the entire fabric of a place like Barstool Sports, because it's not like the podcast is not central. It all seems to be these spokes coming off of a brand that is Barstool. So I can imagine that everything feeds everything else. And I'd love for you to talk to us about how that's built and, you know, what that looks like at a Barstool level.
Yeah, that's great. I love the French horn. That's very cool. I think awesome. The thing that's interesting about Barstool is that we hired personalities. We didn't slot people into projects or into productions. Okay. When you look at traditional media, you know, you look at ESPN or Fox or CBS, they have a show. They have a certain number of chairs at a desk in a show, mm-hmm. and they're going to cast. You know, they need the ex-NFL player and they need the analyst and they have the former coach. And then they typically have a woman who's very pretty. Like, it's right. very scripted. Mm-hmm. And they're casting into a show that is the vision of a producer and a director and a bunch of executives. And at Barstool, what we did, because this is really how Dave created it from the beginning, was we hired people and then we built around what that person wanted to talk about and what they wanted to share and the mediums that they wanted to share it in. So, you know, just going forth with the Pat McAfee example, Pat wanted to talk about college football. Pat wanted to talk about life in the Midwest. Pat wanted to talk about, you know, rescue animals. And mm-hmm. what we did was we created an environment where there was a lot of creative freedom. Anybody could pretty much say whatever they want, which is the era of podcasting and the era mm-hmm. of social media. And then we created infrastructure around it. So we taught people how to grow audience by doing those things. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that was really the magic of Barstool.
Wow.
So, Erica, we typically, and again, target audience here, high school kids, and then yep. people that are influencing their lives. Typically, we get a high school student to pre-record a question, but instead, I went back when my high school buddies that found out I was interviewing you. Travis Hook up in the Twin Cities, he number one, he goes, what'd you do wrong in your career that you actually are going to be on a podcast with me? But then he actually had a pretty pointed question that he wanted to get out there. I'm going to share with you. He says, do you think there's a lasting audience for a Barstool-like site geared for women? And if so, why haven't any broken away from the pack?
That's an excellent question. There have been several attempts. Dave Portnoy actually tried to create a brand for women around a talent called Jenna Marbles, probably in early, maybe 2005, 2006, 2007, called Stool La La. Mm-hmm. I tried to create something when I was there called Barstool Chicks. Like, we have been trying to create a female platform really for the entire history of Barstool. And, you know, prior to my time, and certainly during my time, you know, there are brands and there are groups. You know, if you look at Bustle Media Group, or you look at, I think there's a brand called Betches. Like, the funny thing that I see with women is when you look at Barstool, part of what made Barstool so successful was the men at Barstool were willing to share the stage with one another. They morphed in and out of all of the different types of programming. They would have their own shows, but then they would do other shows where they would mix up with one another. And the other thing that I noticed between men and women, and this is just my experience, is the male talent could fight and get really angry with one another and disagree with one another, and then it would be fine the next day. What I found with my experience at Barstool is the women were more concerned on their own show and didn't want to mix up on other shows because it would dilute their show. Mm. And it was just less comfortable. And then when female talent were fighting on the internet, it felt more personal. And it was not something, you know, part of what makes Barstool so interesting is it's a reality show. So there's a lot of drama. And it felt more personal and more hurtful and therefore less funny, if that makes sense, when it was women. So I'm hopeful that there will be a female Barstool Sports in the future. If you look at what Alex Cooper is doing with Call Her Daddy, like, she's built a huge female platform. You look at Brianna Chicken Fry, what she's doing, you look at Chicks in the Office, but I don't know that anyone has created a Saturday Night Live of just for women. And I think it'd be amazing if someone did.
Do you feel, as we sit here in the state of Iowa, the potential for a trickle down from the Caitlin Clark effect? And
I hope so.
Some potential maybe there?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, she's amazing. And what a run. You know, I think she's going to be a catalyst for women's sports, in that men can watch great female athletes. And that's what's so cool about Caitlin Clark, and that it won't really be about the gender. You're just watching great basketball.
Right.
And you're seeing an incredible athlete with incredible drive and a great personality. So I'm really hopeful for the Caitlin Clark effect everywhere.
Sure, sure. So, hey, stepping back a little bit, in your opinion, what education, experience, and skill sets prepare you to be successful? And then this is a selfish question. Thoughts on how you attending a liberal arts college impacted you? Because I'm a fellow liberal arts kid.
I joke when people start talking about math that I'm like, I'm a liberal arts grad. So my dad, you know, thinking about the audience of this podcast, you know, my dad was my high school principal, which was kind of torturous and amazing and torturous all at the same time. I think you need to work hard. I think it's okay. And I think a lot of times, and part of the reason I wrote the book, Nobody Cares About Your Career, is that a lot of times you feel like you're supposed to know something, or you're supposed to have it figured out, or you're supposed to know your path. And the reality is you don't know. And it would be very foolish for you to know, because there's all these wild and weird and wonderful things that can happen in your life that you kind of need to trip on and stumble into, versus being on a conveyor belt and having it all figured out. I think work ethic is really important. And it's hard, I think, in high school, and it gets a little easier in college, because I think the hard thing in high school is you're kind of like, why do I need to work so hard? You know, like, I don't care. If I get a good grade, great. If I don't get a good grade, who cares? But I think for parents and for people who work with kids, I do think there's this moment later on where you start to be motivated to work hard. And that even if it's not happening right now, it will happen. I think the second thing is to be yourself. I think a lot of times, and this, you know, social is affecting this, is everyone is just starting to look and sound and act like everyone else. It's very, very vanilla. Everyone is trying to emulate what they see and mimic what they see on TikTok or Instagram. And its originality is becoming really rare. And I think it really matters. And then the third is, you know, kind of what you were talking about, Matt, like with your daughter, like playing sports, or being, you know, Mark, being part of the band, like be in a play, like be working together with other people to create something, whether it's a production or scoring a goal or building a set or, you know, winning the math Olympics, like whatever, like just be in things with other people. And I think those are the things. And then on the liberal arts front, like I loved college. Like I learned a lot. I learned how to write. I learned how to think better. I met some really incredible people. I loved being immersed in an experience. And I'm happy that I didn't have a major that was like going to set me up for a job. I had a major that I thought was interesting.
I like it. So dive in a little bit. You mentioned Nobody Cares About Your Career. What was the impetus for that? And when are we going to be able to see it?
Yeah, so soon. So the book comes out June 11th. I wrote it because during the pandemic, I had started this podcast. I had started this really stupid thing where I was emailing everyone at Barstool every day to just check in on them. Barstool was a company that was in the office full time, 24/7, 7 days a week. And it was very jarring when we had to go home. And so I stupidly was emailing 250 people every week, which became impossible. So I created this podcast that was one part about what was happening at Barstool and one part was about work. I like to work. I like work. I'm interested in the topic of work. And the podcast had a bunch of Q&As in it. And flash forward, you know, from 2020 to now 2024, I get probably 1,000 questions a week. People want career advice. They want to understand how to handle a problem. They want to rant about their idiot boss. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about work questions. And I was like, gosh, like I have a lot of opinions about work. I've spent most of my life working, and I want to write a book that is about how you can be yourself and be successful, and also about how to navigate what work looks like and feels like and sounds like and smells like and is like right now from somebody who's going through that. And that was really the impetus for the book. And I think the book is, you know, I think it's relevant and approachable if you're in college. I think it's, or in your 50s. And it's really for anybody who wants to be happy and wants to use work as a way to change and evolve their life.
Well, I'm excited. I know a copy of the book's come my direction. I've got a junior in high school who is uber focused right now. And I promise you, he will be reading this book. But little precursor teaser for him and anybody else that's interested in the book, you know, what's a lesson or two that some of these students can learn about the fact that in theory, nobody cares about your career?
Yeah, I think the idea that nobody cares about your career is really important, because I think when you're a high school junior, and I apologize for the amount of swears in the book, there's a fair amount of swearing in the book, things I probably should have said before I came on this, But you know, look, I think it's easy to get in your head. And there's really two things I think that hold you back. One is your ego and the idea that you don't, you know, you're better than this. You don't need to humble yourself. You don't need to put the work in. And the other is your insecurity and the idea that you don't know what you're doing and you might get it wrong. You know, for me, the biggest lesson is you just need to fail all the time. If you are failing all the time, it means you're trying. It means you're endeavoring to be something and do something and try something. And ultimately, you should do what makes you happy and what challenges you. And what the book is really about is, you know, what are easy ways to get started on that journey? How do you have a vision for yourself? And I think if, you know, you're a high schooler, you're like, what's a vision? And like, I'm too young to have a vision. Everybody has a vision. Your vision could be to win the state track meet. Your vision could be to run a 6-minute mile. Your vision could be to do a certain score on your SATs. Your vision could be to get into the college you want. I think once you get there, though, it's like, what do you want to make of this? And I think a lot of times at work and in life, people kind of get lost in the day-to-day and the drama of this and the headache of that versus being like, I really want to improve myself. I really want to change myself. You know, for me, I grew up in a really small town in the middle of New Hampshire, and I just wanted to get out of New Hampshire. That was my vision, was to make enough money so that I could buy clothes at TJ Maxx, and which I did, and get out of New Hampshire. And that was enough. And, you know, that started me on my path. My first job, it was at a terrible company. And I was so jealous. Like, you know, my friends had cool jobs, or they worked for a place that was a good brand. And I worked at like a dial-up internet company that was insanely dysfunctional. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to make the most of this. My first internship, I was a receptionist. And I was like, all right, I'm bored. I don't want to stare at the door all day and greet people. I'm going to make work for myself. And that's what really the book is about, is how do you get started to get on the journey to go somewhere?
I love it. It ties in well with the why of this podcast. So
let me jump in real quick, Matt, on
yeah.
So I was talking in another podcast about my experience early in my career taking auditions. Where, you know, you have to constantly go out there and it literally is the story of fail, fail, fail until one hits.
Yep.
And I teach a lot of college age students and high school students. And I have kind of come to this opinion that individuals need to work on their ability to emotionally process failure. Mm-hmm. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about like the emotional side of this, because I think that a person who's just like scanning the book title might feel that, you know, this is like a completely unemotional thing. But I think all human beings do react to failure in certain ways, and it might affect the way that they proceed forward. So can you tell me a little bit about how you see, you know, like managing your own emotions and how you feel about life, you know, when things aren't necessarily going that great?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think this book is honestly, it's very emotional. That's part of, this is honestly a self-help book that's disguised as a business book. I went and read a bunch of business books and I was like, oh, I want to shoot myself. Like they've got charts and they've got, you know, they're yelling at me about I should be more efficient. And this book is really a conversation about failure. And you know, part of what's hard about failure is it hurts and it, you know, you feel ashamed or embarrassed or stupid or inferior. Like it's all these feelings.
Right.
And I feel these things all the time. I think everyone feels these things all the time because people are human. And when you fall short or fall down, it hurts. But what I talk about a lot in the book is that if you learn how to do this when you're young, and you don't stop at the point where you might get hurt or you might mess up or you might not know it all, mm-hmm. You can really learn a whole lot about yourself. And when you do fail and when you don't get it exactly right, you almost learn more than when you don't fail and when you do get it right. Like you learn a little bit about yourself. You learn something that you can tuck into your gut and tuck into your brain that helps you the next time around say, ooh, I'm going to do this piece differently.
Right.
So I don't know if this is answering your question or not, Mark, but you know, I write about, you know, when you fall down, I take to my bed for like 48 hours. I like sulk, you can have a cry. Like I'm like, I lick my wounds for 48 hours. And then I'm like, okay, what went wrong? Like, what could I have done differently? What should I have done differently? How would I do this? How would I do this again? And I think having that kind of self-talk with yourself can help you. It helps you get from a negative, dark place into a more positive place.
Right.
And I think that is, I think that's hard. And I wish more people were able to do that, because I think if you don't, you know, by being a musician and going for auditions, you're naturally facing rejection all the time. Most people don't put themselves in a place to feel rejection. Mm. And so then when you feel rejection and you're in your 20s or your 30s or your 40s or your 50s, then it's like, oh God, I don't know how to handle this. And right. Learning how to handle stuff early, I think, is a good trick.
Absolutely.
I'm chuckling a little bit. I played defensive back in college football, and all I did was, you know, have to react to the fact that I had a bad short-term memory, because if somebody caught a pass in front of me, I knew they were coming back to me immediately.
Yeah.
I've always said that it's prepared me for sales, because I lose more than I win. And
yeah.
you have to have a bad short-term memory, because yep. Who wants to lose more than they win? So
yeah, that's right. It's a great way to put it. I was a lacrosse goalie in college, and very ugly position to be a lacrosse goalie. I think like even the best lacrosse goalies save like 2%. And I was not a good lacrosse goalie. And it's living to the next play, you know, like yeah. You get scored on, it stinks. You can sit there and have an absolute meltdown, or you're like, all right, I got to figure out how I'm going to get ready again.
Yeah, absolutely. Erica, you've got some different income streams in your life. Our students are always kind of curious. I mean, Food 52, author, and obviously you've had some other stops in your path. I'm a high school kid. Can I make some money doing what you're doing? And if so, you know, what's kind of the trajectory?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I always liked to work and I always wanted to make money. I didn't grow up with any money. And, you know, my first job was a counter person at a very sketchy restaurant in Weirs Beach, New Hampshire. And then my second job after that is I was a busboy. But, you know, I was touching more cash than I had ever, you know, than I'd ever touched before. So I think just working and making money, even if it's at a, what you think is menial or, you know, your clothes smell when you come out of the job, it's still a good way to learn how to work hard and get compensated for what you do. You know, I think kids now are more entrepreneurial than ever. Like, you could create a TikTok or an Instagram and build it up big and make money from that. You could make a t-shirt business and, you know, sell t-shirts and make money from those. You could create events and sell tickets to them and you make a profit from selling events. So I actually think, like, I have kind of boring revenue compared to a lot of entrepreneurial people who are just making money by creating things that don't exist or delivering something that wasn't there before. For me, I think the biggest and best thing high school kids can do is just get any kind of job. And honestly, the worse it is, probably the better it is for you.
Because everything else beyond that feels so good, right?
It feels so good. Like, it's never going to be any worse. Yeah, like being a busboy stinks. Like, literally, like, you're taking dirty dishes and slopping stuff. Now, I'm sure there are way, way, way worse jobs than that. But I was like, if all else fails, I can go back to being a busboy.
For sure. Mine was a dishwasher at a Little Caesars in Parkersburg, West Virginia.
Exactly. Exactly.
Matt, what was yours, man?
I was working in the field and construction, and every day at the end of the day, I had to clean up a insulation line that lined duct work, and it was lined with fiberglass that would get into my hot, sweaty pores. And it was next to impossible to get out of your pores for a couple of days. So it was good motivation to get back to college every fall.
But you couldn't stay away from construction, right?
It literally got my blood. And who knows, maybe that fiberglass is still doing something to me. I don't know. That's great. So, okay. What else we have here? Erica, is there any irony in the fact that you said, you know, you grew up in rural New Hampshire?
Yeah.
You're in the media world, but did I read right? You didn't even have cable TV.
Oh, yeah. We in my family growing up, you could read books, play sports, or stack wood. Those were generally the entertainment options at my house. My parents, we had a tightly rationed TV situation where we didn't have a TV forever. And then two, when we got a TV, there was no remote. So you had to actually get up and go change the channel, which I kids now would be like, that's preposterous, which it was. And then my parents rationed my brother and I to one collective hour of TV a week, which really taught me how to negotiate, because it was all about, are we going to watch MacGyver or what are we watching? And then finally I figured out that my mom had cut off MTV. She had blocked MTV. She had called the cable company and blocked MTV. So I just called the cable company every month and was like, hey, this is Mina Ayers. please put MTV back on our cable box or whatever it was. So there's a lot of good lessons from that.
I love it.
I think that's why I work in media. I think I was deprived of media and that's why I wanted to work in it.
So I love that answer. So also with doing some of the research on Food 52, I saw a little footnote at the bottom of the landing page about affiliate marketing. And can you talk about how, again, you were talking about entrepreneurs and opportunity. Educate some of the folks or maybe expand a little bit about that for what that means to individuals.
Yeah, so affiliate marketing is essentially, the internet has gotten so big that everyone is trying to feed all of these mouths all the time. And affiliate marketing is essentially just putting your products onto other people's pages, right? So let's say I had a t-shirt company. I'd want to plug into anyone writing about cool t-shirts. And that's affiliate. The way the business works is if I'm at marksTshirtShop.com and he's like, oh, Erica's t-shirts are so cool, blah, 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 which naturally Mark would say.
Absolutely.
Obviously. when I sell a t-shirt off of Mark's website, Mark gets a cut. And so I think affiliate is interesting because it's learning how to have other people sell for you. Mm-hmm. It's putting your goods or your services in somebody else's environment, incentivizing them to help you make money.
How important do you think it is for, someone who is setting up a brand to like really vet where their products are being placed? Or is it really just about trying to get in as many places as possible?
That's a great question. You know, I think it depends. I'm more of the mindset of you should care where your stuff is because mm-hmm. your brand is, as humans, our brand is, you know, our brands are defined by who you stand next to, what you stand for, who you are. So I'm a little bit more in the latter in terms of you should care. You know, you should really care about where your stuff is. If you have a product that you're like, I don't care who talks about this or where they put it or what they say about it, I just want as many people to see it as humanly possible, then I think you can be less discerning. But I think it's a choice.
Okay, for sure.
Before I probably delve into what our typical last question is, real important one though. You're in the food space. I lived in Chicago for 17 years. You're in the New York area. What's best cities in the United States for you to go grab a meal?
Ooh, all right. Best food cities in America. I love this. Okay. I like Chicago food. I think Chicago sneaky has incredible pizza. Mm-hmm. So I like that about Chicago. I like to eat meat in like the Northwest. Like it's bison and it's all different types of animals than you would find on the East Coast. I like to eat a lot of vegetables. So I like, you know, New England and farms and, you know, I think farm to table is a big New England thing, which I like. I like seafood. You know, Maine is incredible for a lobster roll. I don't know if that answers your question, but.
It does. We got some geography. We got a city or two named there. So that's all right.
All right.
I appreciate that.
And I'll pretty much eat anywhere.
Well, it's one of those, again, that because of this podcast, I reflect if somebody maybe would have taken a little time to hold my hand as a kid growing up. Who knows? I might have been a chef, but. In the meantime, I get to be hobbyist in that space and enjoy cooking.
Yeah, so. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, Mark, anything else that's circulating in your head before we get to our typical wrap up?
I think I just have one last one, which is what was it like for you to plug into? I'm sorry, I keep going back to the bar stool thing, but for me, that's, I think, where I'm most connected to you. What was it like for you to plug into a brand like that as like the first CEO? Because, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, when you were saying something about like how we're all kind of acting the same on the internet, and Barstool, I think, is the other side of that spectrum. And like, I don't know, did you have relationships with these folks? Like, tell me about like your onboarding into that culture.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was funny. When I got to Barstool, I was the only woman there. Right. So first they'd never had a CEO, and then they didn't have any women working there, and they certainly had never had a female CEO. I really liked Dave and the Barstool guys. And over time we added a lot of women. But the reason I liked them so much was they're really hardworking. There was something that was just really pure and focused about what they were doing all day. I had come from really, really big media companies where there's a lot of people and there was a lot of politics and, you know, it was kind of like take a number, get in line. And the mm-hmm. thing that was so incredible about Barstool, and I would say this to anybody listening to this, go work at a startup with a really crazy motivated founder. It may be a disaster. It may be a wild success, but it will be something, you know. And I really loved the Barstool people because they really welcomed me, because I also was really focused and wanted to work and wanted to build something. And we got along great. And the thing that was cool about Barstool was it was come as you are mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. let's build something and do something together. So it was interesting, actually. It was, it actually was one of the easiest entries I've ever had. And it was one of the most unifying places I've ever worked, which is not the Barstool reputation. I look at the difference of joining Barstool versus joining Food 52, joining Food 52 is a million times harder. Hmm. You know, people are like, you don't come from food. You didn't work at Williams-Sonoma. Why should we listen to you? And the Barstool people were like, hey, what do you think we can make? You want to try something? Mm. And so I think working at small companies that, you know, and this is partly the reason for the book, which is you can learn a great deal from anyone, anywhere, but putting yourself in environments where you can really learn from people who are on the edge and doing things. I find most people who are really focused on a mission are the most accepting and the most gratifying to work with.
Erica, I've got to ask the question, and I wasn't originally thinking about this until you just started talking about that. Can you tell our listeners about your interview process for Barstool? I read about it, and I think it was fascinating to see how you set yourself apart.
So I had stumbled on learning about that Barstool was looking for a CEO, and I was very jealous when I read it. I knew like somewhere deep inside me that it was my job. Hmm. And I stalked pretty much anyone I could possibly find to introduce me to Dave. And I kept at it. I mean, every day, every week, I just like kept at it. Meanwhile, Barstool and the investor behind it was going through an interview process. And I think they had interviewed probably 50, 60, 70. I think there were 74 people who came before me. They were all men. They were all from sports. They were MBAs. They were, you know, they looked the part. And then somehow, finally, I got an introduction to Dave. Not through the recruiters, not through the system, kind of on the outside. And it was after that meeting that I became the 75th candidate and ultimately became the one. But it was not, you know, I would say this, I think, and I write about this a lot in the book, is I'll give you an example, and I know I'm being long-winded, but after college, I wanted to work for Converse. I thought Converse was so cool. I wanted to live in Boston. I wanted to work at a sneaker company. And I think I sent my resume in like 45 times. Like I just kept applying to Converse. But I never did anything special to deserve a job at Converse. Mm. And if you asked me why I wanted to work at Converse, I was like, it's because it's cool. And that's not a good enough reason. That drives me nuts when people, you know, when people would come up to me when I was the CEO of Barstool and be like, oh, I would do anything to work for Barstool. I want to work for Barstool. And my next question was always, well, what would you do here? And then there was like silence, like, or why do you want to work here? Well, it's cool. Okay. Well, like, yeah, it's cool, but you got to have a reason. And I also think people should get creative about setting yourself apart. We've had people apply to Barstool with their resumes on a pizza box. We had a guy sing it as a telegram. I had somebody write a book. Like, so going the extra mile to get a job, I think, is really important. And that was, it was true for me as well.
I appreciate that. So, well, Mark, anything else?
No, but could I ask the last question?
Of course you can.
It's always yours, Matt, but I really want to do it, man.
I love it,
Mark. So, Erica, what would you tell your 16-year-old self to keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to increase the chances for post-high school success and happiness?
Ooh, okay. So I would tell my 16-year-old self to keep being weird. keep being weird. I would tell my 16-year-old self to stop worrying so much about hair care and makeup and the trimmings of things. And what was the third one, Mark?
What would you start doing?
Start doing. I would have told my 16-year-old self to start believing that it would be okay to take a risk, to stop being afraid to take, you know, to start being open to risk earlier.
Well, Erica, you are absolutely a real piece of work, and we've absolutely loved the conversation with you and appreciate you being a part of this journey for our high school students beyond.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you guys later, but thank you so much for having me.
Of course.
Thanks, Erica.
Okay, goodbye.
Well, Mark, you know, as my producer of this podcast, I really appreciate you stepping in and pinch hitting once again. Very capable hands, obviously. And to my listeners, please check out Mark's podcast, What's Happening QC. That's produced through WBIK, just like our podcast is here. But, you know, reflecting on this conversation with Erica today, I got to bring it back to what the initial was of me commenting about my daughter walking off a soccer pitch on Tuesday crying. And after consoling, as a father should, a parent should, eventually I did say to her, chin up. And I think if I took something from the conversation with Erica today is that, you know, there's failures part of life. Mm-hmm. She would take 48 hours to reflect upon it. But then I would say, chin up and let's get out back out there again and try to find some success. And maybe then that next success story in your life. So I can't wait to read her book and see what you know, the book Nobody Cares About Your Career is all about. So anything else that's jumping out at you?
Well, I mean, you know, I, as a native West Virginian, I always want to talk about Pat McAfee because he was our kicker at WVU when I was in school. I think that one of the things that I took away from this, and I think it kind of relates to the work that I do here at WVIK for both my shows and for everyone else's shows, it's like growth sometimes seems so like the timeline for growth is so long, right? Or that you're like, you know, we're making episodes every month, or like with What's Happening QC, I'm making one every single week. And, you know, like even on weeks in which like I feel like a guest that I have is going to help numbers like go up exponentially, it's like just staying at it and kind of seeing that, you know, the two that you add every week will add up eventually. And then that becomes more and more. And, you know, I really liked when she was talking about kind of leveraging your brand and attaching it to other people's brands as well and websites. So like, you know, you can't spend your way to success in terms of advertising in the podcasting world. So, you know, connecting with others and being everywhere that you possibly can, you know, is the right way to go. And it's cool to hear how she's been able to apply some of that within places that are, you know, definitely larger than what we're doing here at WVIK. So, no, it's a great interview. And thanks for letting me step in, Matt. I always enjoy interviewing folks with you.
Always enjoyable, Mark. I appreciate your time today.
Of course, man.
Have a good one.
All right. Later on, Matt.
Later, bud. Bye.